It's lovely to see all of you and to have a chance to think together and talk together about what to my mind is the most demanding and dramatic event unfolding in our history, indeed in the history of our fledgling and suffering world since the Second World War. I can think of nothing more dramatic than what is at foot in the world today. So it's not surprising that it splashes across the newspapers every day. And it's also not particularly surprising that last time we gathered and you talked together and spoke a bit about your concerns, that a whole group of them emerged, and Ray did such a lovely job collating this and giving it to me in various forms on various colored papers. You would think he was a missionary. I particularly appreciate the fact that you spoke so frankly, and it seemed to me, at least, freely. And I, because I don't think one can get very far unless our fears and desires become conscious to us. We don't have much chance to understand them for what they really are, to take them seriously instead of literally, and where necessary, to act, and where necessary, to seek healing. So I thank you for that. So I think of this morning around three things. I want to do three things with you, and you can change it. I'll give you a chance to speak to that in just a minute. I would like to walk through some of what was gathered together from our last time, and to think out loud about it a little bit. So that's number one. What are the fears that emerge? And the second one, if you're interested, what would you like to know about Islam and have never dared to ask? Are there things about Islam and Muslims that it would be useful for you to raise and that we could speak about a little bit? And then the third one is, given our thinking and conversation together, what is the responsibility of Christians? Put another way, what is the ability of Christians to respond to the kind of challenges that we face in Canada, that we face geopolitically, that we face with our neighbors, that we face with Christians in many other parts of the world, Muslims in many other parts of the world? So how does that sound to you? You want to dump one of them? Please, Ray.
In regard to the second one, many of the questions we had about the nature of Islam were included under comments.
Right.
So we've already raised some of them.
You have raised some of them, yeah. And we can visit those. And maybe we'll accomplish it, and you can all go home for the third period of and watch Finland best, our good friends to the south. Norway's done so poorly. I mean, Only 5 million people, huh? Did any of you hear the interview last night with the principal of the high school in Norway, which has sent like 20 Olympians? It's a fantastic interview. Talks about how you only train an athlete. You never train an athlete to win. You train an athlete so after 12 to 15 years, they are a well-grounded human being able to endure. It's a marvelous interview. So, is that okay with you if we walk that path? Do you want me to just draw the fears forward and maybe you can speak, somebody can speak to them a little bit? Not surprisingly, that a major sort of fear that it emerges is associated with what is called radical Islam in your comments, with the bombings in Kabul and elsewhere, a concern that there is a small, perhaps some thought, a small cadre of Muslims who have extremist views. So, what do you say? You want to, you see this problem? Does anybody want to elaborate on it? Maybe I can speak to it a bit. Raise the master of the mic. Peter would like to speak about it a bit.
I hadn't actually thought of this until now, but when you talk about those cadres, what I guess I am fearful of, you know, if something happens in Kabul, I'm upset by it, but I don't feel threatened. But there's a phenomenon happening in North America where young men are converting to Islam and becoming terrorists immediately, and I don't know if that's typical of converts or that's some kind of anomaly, but we had, in Canada, United States, we had these young men embracing radical Islam. For what reason, I don't know.
Yeah. You know, after 9/11, within the 2 years following 9/11, there were more converts to Islam in the United States than ever before in history. How come? Why? What is it? Are there any converts to Christianity in the room? I didn't think so. Ray, you know, losing your edge. Why do people convert? Can you cast your mind back, think of people that you've known who have undergone some kind of transformation in their life or turned the world around? What's at work in that? Why do people decide, I'm no longer going to identify here, I'm going to identify here? Think of it in terms of Christianity. Let's think of it in terms of the Apostle Paul. Yes?
Because they're drawn to a spirit, either the spirit of good or the spirit of evil. It seemed so evil to have 9/11 that others that were already going that way thought, yeah, that's the way to get noticed. The same way that others are drawn by the Holy Spirit to the goodness in God, we're drawn.
Good. Other reflections?
I think one of the things that happened, I've seen this happen in two people I know, and they have changed. Both of them became Jehovah's Witnesses, and that was because they were offered a chance as very lonely people to become part of a group. Mm. It was just almost that simple.
Uh-huh.
That we need to be in a community. And if these people offer a community, then we sort of go into it, and then whatever the community does, we just go along with it.
Right. Because the need for some relationship is so deep. And so you're willing to enter into it in a kind of thoroughness. So we have over here a sense that you can become part of something in order to make your mark in life. And whether it's evil or good, it's the appetite to make your mark. Did I capture that okay? And over here, it's that loneliness, sense of isolation and alienation. Any others?
I think amongst young people today, there's a certain malaise that seems to be caused by the split between the rich and the poor, possibly. And I think something like radical Islam seems to attract that kind of mind, in it, so that they can turn things around to where it is more to their satisfaction or more to their well-being.
And that well-being, how would you characterize that? What do you think that looks like?
Well, to have a more of a say in how things are conducted in the world and to control that.
It's meaning for life. What is the meaning? What am I here for?
Power has always been attractive. And when...
Particularly the Danes.
They'll overtake anything. When we see the trends within our youth, the increase in violence in schools, the shootings, malls, whatever, this increase, to me, it's a group of individuals who have struggled to find a venue in which to make a statement. And when there is so much visibility around violence as an avenue to proclaim your needs, what's innermost hurting within you, and often it's demonstrated in this power. The ability and the power to be able to see yourself as above and beyond. And it's playing out in violent ways, because maybe there's no other place for these people to go that they know of.
Final. Anybody else want to take a kick at this before we walk into the movie?
This may be just restating what you said, but I think, I certainly feel this way, and I think a lot of youth do, not that I'm one of the youth, but I think there's a sense of powerlessness, of inability to affect change in our society, that power is centered in a few people who are running things. And I think the attraction of radical Islam is that these young men feel, I can make a difference there's something I can really give my life to, and which I find a little bit paradoxical in the sense that, if I'm not mistaken, Islam is not a proselytizing faith. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what I have read. So it's they're obviously being influenced somehow, but I don't think by direct approach to them.
So there's a few things that surface there, and let's just think out loud together a little bit about them. It's this issue of malaise, that deep sense of meaninglessness, which occasionally grips certain societies, certain periods in human history, certain people. And out of that malaise, out of that sense of meaninglessness, there is an appetite for purpose, an appetite for a world of meaning. And often that appetite is so strong, it longs for a total package. I've argued for years that when you create a culture of meaninglessness, you actually seed the fields of fascism, where the culture is clear-cut of its narratives, of its great stories of meaning, where the culture is clear-cut of those stories, those images, those ideas, those practices. You create, you seed, at least for some, the fields of fascism. That is, you create the circumstances whereby people desperately want a whole package. Now that can take many forms. Not forms simply that we normally think of as religious. In fact, the 20th century has seen the opposite. The 20th century has been the bloodiest century in human history, and it hasn't been religious wars. It's been forms of totalitarianism that are bound to ideologies that are deeply secular and formally atheist. We sometimes forget it. And also, the 20th century has been a century in which the development of so-called industrial societies has expanded so much that, as the great political thinker Hannah Arendt has pointed out, evil has become banal. That it's been simply systemic. It's the inability of people to do anything but follow orders and implement policy and procedures, no matter what. We see it in all of our institutions. The inability to think. So let me just say a couple things about, pull a couple threads forward that have to do something, that have a bit to do with what you flagged here. In the last 50 years or so, I mean, there's been a debate on within Muslim communities and societies which are largely Muslim. There's been a debate on for about 150 years about how, as a Muslim, how in the context of Islam do you engage the modern world? Now, Christians know something about this, because actually, in many ways, it is Christian Europe that largely created very foundational dimensions of the modern world. Things like modern science have several roots. Islam has contributed substantially to the development of science. But it is really in 17th century Europe that, and it is really in Puritan religious cultures in the UK and in Pietist religious cultures in Germany, that the modern institutions of science develop. And they develop over against what is seen as the hegemony of the state churches, and out of a sense that creation is a wonder. And the more you understand that, the more you will be alert to the wonder and glory of God. It's a wonderful story, largely forgotten and not taught in our universities, but obvious. There was a great essay on this by Robert K. Merton, a sociologist. Modern Europe, modern Christian Europe, is really the place where we see the birth of the nation state. The Reformation was sort of the last straw for the so-called Holy Roman Empire. And you end up with the development of nation states, and with nation states that at least initially go into an awful, awful period. I guess my key illustration of this is our friends just north of Camrose, the Hutterian Brethren. In the 30 Years' War, which followed the end of the Holy Roman Empire and the development of nation states and the development of state-sponsored religion in the nation states, Germany still has two state-sponsored religions. England has one. France dumped its. And Sweden, in the year 2000, decided to give Jesus a birthday present by disestablishing the church. But that's a long story. Europe was largely states which sponsored a particular religious faith. In the 30 Years' War, historians debate this a little bit, but an enormous number of the intellectual, religious, artistic, political leaders of that part of the world lost their lives. For me, the 30 Years' War is worth contemplating because there's a big part of me that really thinks it's the only even remote parallel to part of what we see happening within the worlds that are largely Muslim today. The 30 Years' War occurs for a number of reasons. There are several layers here, but one of them was, who is going to define the faith in truth? Is it going to be Martin Luther? Zwingli? Calvin? Who's it going to be? Is it going to be the papal nuncio? Who's going to do it? So we end up with this awful tussle. Or is it going to be the Anabaptists? Is it going to be Jakob Hutter? Or is it going to be Minnow Simons? A complete rejection of the notion that the church should have anything to do of a substantive nature with the state. So in the 30 Years' War, we have the beginning of the ecumenical movement. This is a tough lesson. Catholics, Lutherans, Calvinists finally get together over against the Anabaptists. They became the victim of choice. Because after all, they weren't willing to have an army. The ancestors of our Hutterite neighbors, their leadership studied Hebrew with rabbis in Rotterdam and Amsterdam, and they knew Latin and Greek, and they are one of the sources for modern humanism. And they were all killed. And so Hutterites go to school till grade 8. Think of it. We live with the legacy of the 30 Years' War down to our own day. You can clear-cut culture. You can narrow the frame dramatically. Modern Europe, the development of modern Europe, also gives us this whole new notion of the secular. Born out of that enormous battle, the 30 Years' War. And this notion of the secular is still a problem for us. We still struggle with it. In vivid kind of ways, with our, we see our, the province of Quebec passing legislation about medical assisted suicide. They don't like it called that, I guess. The right to die. Call it what you wish. We see them pass their legislation or bring their legislation forward around a charter of values. That's a dramatic example. We see examples in many other places in the world. Turkey. Place I've spent some time and have great affection for. The great revolution in Turkey, 23, 24, 25 of the last century, we see a military leader, Ataturk, emerge and establish, really adopt the pattern of the French Revolution. What's that pattern about? How did that come about? I remember the first and only time, I guess, I've been in France. Some of you live there and know it so much better than I. But I remember going up and having a little chat with Quasimodo, you know, on top of the Notre Dame Cathedral. He was in pretty good shape. It was a dank day, but not too bad. And then going to the great museums of France, and then going to Chartres Cathedral, and then going to a Cistercian monastery where no monastic had lived since the first 2 weeks of the revolution. Some of them escaped and went to England and America. Most Cistercians, a religious reform that occurred in France of an extraordinary nature, very few of them live in France. They were expunged or killed. Women and men. Le Fontenay, a UNESCO World Historic Site, this monastery, it's a remarkably beautiful place. But I walked through the gates, it's of course privately owned. It's one of the nice things about these sorts of clear cuttings of religious culture. It creates more private property, more real estate deals. But I remember walking into the chapel there, and the Cistercian architecture is so remarkable. You know, it's kind of Protestant in a way. It's white, very little imagery. It's deeply, deeply contemplative. And I thought back on my old friend Bernard of Clairvaux and John of Ford and the Cistercian women, Dijon. The women who in the monastery in Dijon were arrested on Tuesday afternoon and marched 300 meters down the street to Les Donjons. And then on Sunday, Madame Guillotine came to town. There were 43 of them. The youngest was 14. The oldest was probably 85. And they were taken to the Central Park and introduced to Madame Guillotine. You want to understand part of what's gone on in France, certainly around the issue of the secular, you have to rethink that. France has yet to come to terms with what it did to itself. It's curious. France is a world of museums, more museums than any other country in the world, but no museum to the revolution. There is an extraordinary book about this written by the great Julia Kristeva, literary critic, psychoanalyst, called, what's it called? Strangers to Ourselves. The failure to integrate what really happened in our own world. So, my point is simply that in Europe, Christian Europe, we, over since the 16th century, have laid the foundations for the modern world, and it was enormously painful. Enormously painful. The secular, the whole process of urbanization, industrialization, the nation state, and all that that means, all of the change that that brings about to community, to culture, to the relationship to the other. And in that, there are amazing gifts. And all of us at this point in life in the 21st century treasure some of those gifts. We treasure individual right and freedom. We treasure the notions of progress that mean we don't walk down stinking streets. We treasure nations which have somehow or other come to terms with pluralism so that we're not fearful about our neighbors. But you know, that's a 400-year story. And it's a story that is just unfolding in some parts of the world. So when we look at some of the roots of what's happened and what is unfolding in parts of the Muslim world, there are a few telling examples, things that may be illuminating to us. There is this 150-year debate in which you have a number of people within Muslim worlds who studied in Europe and who became convinced of what they saw as the kind of secularism of France. And so they import that, and they seek to make the case for that in various Muslim countries. And for periods of time, they win the day. Certainly did in Turkey. And as a result, from 1925, 10 years ago or so, there was no religious education in Turkey. Not Muslim, not Christian, not anything. During that period, if you wanted to become part of the army, you had to sign an oath that you were an atheist. And so did your family. And if any of them were found in the shadow of a mosque, since all the churches were already disappeared, or if any of them were found with the Quran or the works of Bedouzaman Said Nursi or reading Gulen, you were thrown in prison, stripped of your pension, and tossed into the street after 8 years. Where does that come from? It's the same story as the story of my Cistercian sisters. That's where it comes from.
It comes from a virulent understanding of secularism. God, I'll grant you this. Maybe that's necessary. Maybe it's necessary when you have a brittle religious world. Maybe it's necessary. But my God, it ought to be done in tears, not triumphalism. So one approach is that approach. And that approach was enormously successful. Why? Because it's virulently secular and because it's deeply committed to progress and what is understood as the modern, which made it possible to make all those marvelous links with the West around resources. And what we call resources and development. So whether it's the Baathists or Ataturk, that's how it works. But that's only one scenario. You then have this marvelous example in Saudi Arabia, which is fantastic, where they're developed several hundred years ago under the influence of a remarkable man named Wahhab. He was a reformer. He was a seeker initially, a person that wanted to understand what is the pure faith, what is real Islam like, without these accretions that look somewhat pagan to him. Does this sound familiar? Sound a little bit like maybe our good friend Luther or Calvin? A little bit like the Puritans in England. Those impulses may be holy. They may be holy, but they're always dangerous. Because the holy is dangerous. The holy isn't good. The sacred isn't good. It's powerful, and it can swing both ways. So, Wahhab went on a journey. And it's interesting, there's a nice connection to Camrose. Does anybody know about the Wahhabist connection to Camrose? It's so nice, you know, to be able to tell you things you don't know, because there's so few I can tell you. At Augustana, 4 years ago, we had the great, 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 great granddaughter of Wahhab. She came and studied here. She wants to be a doctor. She's on her way. But she came from Riyadh and studied here, took off all of her clothes, so to speak, you know, the veil and stuff. You would never have recognized her. Her family would have never recognized her on the streets of Camrose. But she was a lovely person. And she came to a class that Dietmar and I were teaching, and she stayed, and then she got really interested in religious studies, so I did a fair bit of work with her. And one thing I did with her was I had her revisit her relatives and to talk with her mother and her grandmother about their memory and understanding of that great reformer. Now, that great reformer had traveled all over the Muslim world to try and purify the faith, to get the distilled core of the faith. How often have you heard that from me or anyone else? Wanting the pure core of the faith with no accretions. That's a holy impulse. It's a dangerous impulse. And it's a holy impulse. It's often useful to remember that Satan, Lucifer, is the angel of light. Light's interesting. I often think that ideologies, unlike religious faith, I think religious faith is the antidote to ideology myself. And that is because ideologies shine spotlights on diseases. They're terrific. They're terribly important because they highlight dis-ease. But it's a narrow light. And when it shines, you don't see what's outside the circle. And it's never complex. Faith doesn't work that way. It seeks to be present to reality, which is far beyond any ideology. In any case, Wahhab, I guess I come out of the closet on this one, who I think was an ideological thinker, not actually a theologian. But he won the day. I mean, there was a struggle around it, but he attempted to purify, as he understood it, the faith. And that meant a number of things. And of course, as we have seen in the 20th century, that particular view of things gets linked through the great princely family of Saudi Arabia, and they meet with the Americans and the oil industry. And so Saudi Arabia, on the one hand, becomes what most people would consider this kind of fundamentalist world in its culture, but deeply committed to providing the resources of oil to the rest of the world, and deeply in bed with the West. And as a result, a really, really unusual place. But a place which has actually had, most of my Muslim friends would say, never consider Saudi Arabia when you talk about Islam. It's an aberration. Yeah, right, it is. But it's a powerful one. And so it must be considered. And of course, they've used their funds to support the development of schools to teach Islam all over the world, as well as to build mosques in many places around the world. We have one in Edmonton, built by a Saudi prince. Well, that's another scenario. But then there's another one. And it's one that's been very powerful in the development of what you have identified as some of your concerns and fears here around radical Islam. And that's an Egyptian intellectual, Said Qutb, who studied in the United States. You know, it's very interesting. We think often that what is called radical Islam, I'm trying to find another way to think about this. I don't want to give the word Islam to these people any more than I want to give the word Christian to Jerry Falwell. It's not what it is. You can't have the word. But I haven't quite figured out how to do it. Maybe we can do that together this morning. Qutb goes and studies, does an MA in English literature, Colorado. Well, late 50s, early 60s, I can't remember exactly when. I didn't check the date. And he undergoes what I think is a trauma. This is a man who comes from a desert culture. If you come from a desert culture, what do you think it means to walk down the street of a suburb and to look at lawn sprinklers? Watch people with manicured lawns. And if you come from that world and somebody's hospitable to you and you're invited to a church for a gathering of young people and they turn the lights down low and they begin to dance, men and women dancing together. This is something that used to be an issue here at Messiah, as I recall. I was raised in the non-dancing world. You know what the real danger of that is? It really heightens the eroticism of dancing. That's the problem with it, but that wasn't quite understood. But that's what happened to him. So he begins to write letters back. I've taken and given a couple of his letters to some of my students without saying who he was, not that they would know, and asked them what they thought of it, particularly the one he writes about wands. Because our students nowadays, under the influence of many of the professors at Augustana, deeply interested in ecological issues. They really agree with him. This is fantastic, the way he's put this. He identified the diseases, the issues of the rich and the poor. But you know what? The intellectual leaders of radical, so-called radical Islam, all of them, virtually all of them, have Western educations. France, England, America. And none of them are poor. So it's interesting. He goes back to Egypt, gets involved in the Muslim Brotherhood, is accused, at least, I don't know the details, of being part of the assassination of Sadat, thrown in prison, and of course prison's a wonderful contemplative place. So he writes Milestones, this extraordinary commentary on the Quran, which lays the foundation for a new way of thinking about being Muslim. He redefines the notion of pagan, or Jahiliyyah, and says, just because you have a leader in the Muslim world who claims to be Muslim, if he's not really living up to the Sharia, he isn't, and is subject to being wiped out. It shifts the world, or at least it provides another prism through which to see things. So, there are, as some of you have spoken, many young people who are on a quest, a search. They want community. They want something worth living for, and even more than that, they may want something worth dying for. That's one of the shocking revelations of 9/11. What are you willing to die for? So, within many Muslim communities in the world, we have these various ways of trying to figure out how are we to be faithful in the midst of the unfolding of the Muslim, of the modern world. This is the same question that faced Europeans in the 16th century. And in many ways, it's the question that every age has to ask itself. Big differences are, we have modern media. The amazing capacity of the modern media to frame things to help us see them. So we are fed an appetite associated with the horrors and tragedies of the world, and you have to dig to find anything else. But there's lots else there. Lots else. That's not the, it's not only the only story. I would say it's the story that dominates the media, but it's not the story that dominates communities. If that narrative was the narrative for most Muslims in our world, you and I wouldn't be sitting here. And we wouldn't be sitting here because we are in no condition to resist that image, that narrative, if in fact it was the self-understanding of a well over a billion people in the world. Clearly it is not. But it is a dynamic within the communities. and within the communities everywhere. And why shouldn't it be? Look at the dynamic within Christian communities. You know, within Christian communities, there's a struggle around meaning, how it's going to be understood, what our children think, how they're going to live. So it's a dynamic, it's a dramatic matter that we face here. But one of my, I think that being able out of the history of the West to think about what, how these challenges of becoming modern unfolded in the West, and being able to talk with our Muslim brothers and sisters about that, is a great source of solidarity. It heightens what I think is our continuing struggle around questions of meaning in the modern world. It helps us understand that those struggles are within our Muslim brothers and sisters as well. It may even provide Muslims who want to think about this with some ability to wrestle better with the struggle around modernity than they would otherwise have. As some of you know, I had Andy Bannister here a week or two ago, who's the chief apologist for Ravi Zachariah Ministries. And we did a number of things in Edmonton and here. And he was interesting. But over dinner, I had a conversation with him, because he did his PhD in Islam at Oxford. Which sounds pretty neutral, doesn't it? Sounds pretty prestigious, especially if you speak, have an English accent. The only problem is this. Islamic studies at Oxford is all funded by the Saudis. Islamic studies at Oxford is all funded by the Saudis. So, who do you have as scholars there? You have the equivalent of Liberty University. I'm serious. And by that, I'm not being critical of Liberty University. I'm just saying, you've got people with a spotlight. So a Christian apologist does a PhD in Islamic studies there. What do you think he thinks about Islam? No matter how often he says dialogue. He is convinced, just as Christopher Hitchens was convinced that Jerry Falwell was a Christian. And that's the tragedy. How to open up the space so that we do not have Wahhabism versus Nasser. Jerry Falwell versus Christopher Hitchens. I'm happy to have them speak, but not represent the extraordinary world of Islam, or the extraordinary world that I love and hold so dear, Christianity. And who do we invite? Who do we bring into the public sphere to make the case? My own university makes use of money from the Muslim community to establish the first chair in Islamic studies. And the summer that that person arrives, Ibrahim Abu-Rabi, at the Festival of Ideas, who do they bring? They bring the great Bangladeshi writer,
who wrote the satanic verses, and they bring Ali. Her book is over there. Yeah, the Somali woman. Do those people have something to say? Oh, you bet they do. But it is exactly like talking to a refugee about their homeland and expect that you get a picture of their homeland. You get the picture of their diseases. It is exactly like talking to a surgeon about the human body. You find out about tumors. You don't find out about the human body or the great gifts. So we have a problem in our world with the way in which these things are handled and brought forward. And we have a challenge around how to move beyond that. Not to ignore what's happening, because there are extraordinary things happening. And they're deeply, deeply problematic in our world. It is the case that in the homeland of so much of Christianity, in the Near East, and in Turkey, if things continue the way they are, there will be no Christians there. And there are very few now. So, why? Who's to blame? Or what do we do? Well, how supportive are you of Israel? Because if you have a one-dimensional support of Israel, then you are also part of the expunging of Christians from the Near East. Like it or not. And oddly enough, who are those Christians? Well, check their genetic code. You'll find that most of them carry Jewish genes, whatever those are, much more than the ones that came from Europe. So even if you're a Christian Zionist, what are you up to? What's going on? So ethnic cleansing, and certainly the plight of Christians in many of these places, also has a great deal to do with how we respond to these matters. We have got to find ways to think about how to respond to nations and states and communities when those nations and states and communities are taken, where the political power ends up in the hands of secularists and of people with virulent religious ideas. Because when it ends up in the hands of virulent secularists, and let's just take that unbelievable struggling country, Syria. I saw this when I was there, just before all hell broke loose. Minorities, like the Syrian Christian community, are in a situation where they identify with the secular leadership. And it seems understandable, because the secular leadership talks about pluralism. But how does it talk about it? Well, it talks about it like Quebec talks about it, or like France talks about it. It's fine to be Christian or Muslim or Jewish or anything else. Just keep it to yourself. And there's no public space for any of that. So when you identify with that kind of virulent dictatorial regime, and again, I think despots are okay for 10 years. Sometimes they're necessary for 10 years. But if you don't figure out how to put something between your despotism
and the people in 10 years, when the hammer comes down, it will all collapse. So in Syria, what happens now to the Christians? In Egypt, what happens to them? In Iraq, what happens to them? The list goes on. They saw no approach but identifying with the virulent secularists. But you know, you've got to build bridges with your neighbors. You've got to find Muslims and Christians who can weave their lives together, because they have so much common concern for the life of the world. And frankly, I think common interest in finding much better ways to enter and live the modern world. Much better ways. The way France found, the way we find, the way America has found, these all have gifts in them. But they're all limited. Put not your faith in princes and the sons of men. Modernity can be lived in a variety of ways, not just one way. And to me, that's the big issue behind all this. Just as it is the big issue for our first peoples. It's not about schools. It's about how do we live the modern world. Is there any room in it for our aspirations, our culture, our faith? And if so, how much room? How do we configure that? How does that sit with the modern state? Well, I got carried away. Is that of any use? You want to speak to it? And we should break for coffee? Do you want to raise some things around this? What do you hear? Go ahead. Let loose. Please. Ray, over there.
That's a lot of serious stuff. I think we need something on the lighter side. So I'd like to draw your attention to four very important religious truths. This comes from a Mennonite, so you understand that.
My favorite heretics.
People of all faith should remember these four great religious truths. Muslims do not recognize Jews as God's chosen people. Jews do not recognize Christ as the Messiah. Protestants do not recognize the Pope as the leader of the Christian world. And this comes from the U.S. The Mennonites do not recognize each other at Hooters or at the liquor store. On the serious side, you've drawn our attention to so many of the complexity of this whole issue. I ask myself, who speaks for the Muslims? Who speaks for the Christian church? There are so many, many different voices, and there's always some truth that can be seen in each of them. But when every one of us feels that we have all the truth, that's when the danger begins. And my concern is not the fact that there are some radical Muslims. We've always had radicals in every movement, any group, whether it's political or religious, you name it, even the secularists. That just happens. My concern would be that I do not have to live in fear, but I cannot live in ignorance and be indifferent to what is happening in the world when radicals basically hold the day. And I'm not concerned that some radicals object because somebody has offended Mohammed. That doesn't bother me. That always happens. I was at Augustana when some student organization printed things about Christ that was so terrible in a Christian college. People are like that. We can't avoid that. What concerns me is the indifference and the ignorance of the majority who just go along put our head in the sand and think all is well. It is not well. When you reflect on World War II, on the Nazis, isn't that the issue again and again? We can be very tolerant, but we cannot be ignorant of the facts that we see around us. And when I think of some of the unreasonable expectations of those who come from Muslim countries to Canada, or want to recreate the Muslim world in Canada, depriving us of these rights and freedoms that have taken, as you've outlined, 400 years. And we know every place where Muslims are in authority, these rights are no longer there. They're gone. And we are undoubtedly in danger of losing some of those rights. I happen to be coming from the educational world, and I know that even to have a prayer room set aside for a Christian group that wants to pray wasn't permitted. It's not permissible in our society. But with Muslims, governments have paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to accommodate special washrooms to wash feet, and on, go down the list, the recent issue with York University. So I'm concerned about, you know, the unreasonableness of the accommodations that those of us who want to be so tolerant and accepting. You know what? If we had a group here, Muslims, and they want to build a church, I would be out there, or a mosque, I would want to help them to do that. But when this becomes a right, you know, and feeling that this is something that this country owes them, I think we are losing our very essence of the freedoms and the rights that many, many people have paid the price over centuries. And I think we need to be tolerant, loving, kind, but we need to be a little bit less than ignorant.
I that's beautifully spoken. No, just hang on to the microphone because we're going to talk. So it seems to me there's two possibilities here, and you have really flagged the direction. How did it come about that Christian prayer no longer existed in schools? Well, you all know that story. How did it come about that the central narratives of the history and culture of the Western world and much of the rest of the world is the only censored book in the curriculum? It's called the Bible. Do you know how unusual that is? If you were to ask our Cree mothers out here, or if you were to ask a 15th century French peasant, or if you were to ask a Cappadocian in a village in the 12th century, I mean, the list goes on. If you were to ask the vast majority of the human family until yesterday, what is the most important thing in the world to them? The answer, if you could figure out their language and how to ask the question, would always be the same. It would be the most important thing to me and to my community is to tell our story to our children. That has not been our... I mean, we're unique. From 1950 on, we're unique. We decided, and educators, you and me, are largely responsible. We're unique. We decided to censor. And we did it for a very interesting reason. We called it tolerance. We called it openness. We said, there's a variety of people here. No longer should the religious stuff be part of the system. So that's interesting. We need to remember that. Remember how this came about. We really replaced a kind of low-grade cultural Christianity with certain kind of psychological doctrines, as I understand. So then we have created this curriculum which has lots of very good things in it, but from a cultural point of view is largely clear-cut. I personally am not particularly interested in prayer in the schools. Be fine with me if we did that. But it's not where I think the bulk of the action is, I would like to restore the content of history and culture to the curriculum, because the content of history and culture is about religion, and we desperately need that. So that's how we got onto this path, and then something begins to happen. We become a little more richly pluralistic, and there are two things to it. You flagged one of them, but the first one predates it, and I'm wondering how you feel about that. At least in Edmonton, we now have two communities that can pray. But the first one was Native. Not only were they invited to smudge in the classroom, they were given money to do it. How do you feel about that? Is that good? Now, I argued 30 years ago with teachers that you can't have pluralism unless you come to terms with Christianity. If you want to have a deeply pluralistic system, then Christianity has to be there too. But who are the big resistors? Well, initially, the resistors were the followers of Madeline Murray O'Hare, you know, sort of virulent atheists, of which there are not very many around. Most atheists don't care enough to be virulent. And Jehovah's Witnesses, who didn't want the faith defined by other communities. So that's where the first push comes back to expunge any religious material from the school system. But it was followed very quickly by most of us who are kind of glib secularists. But I love the fact that Muslims have put that pressure on. Not only have they put that pressure on for having a place to pray in the school, they put the pressure on for having the curriculum take Islam seriously. So where are you, if you care? This is an opportunity. There are companions. Unless you are a very serious, I use a harsh word perhaps, virulent secularist, and think that the system ought to be expunged and never should have any of that content in it. But I would argue if you really are that, then you don't want your children to have an education, because you can't teach history and culture and not teach about the extraordinary place, formative place of Christianity and Islam. So what I would suggest, I'd like you to respond to this. Instead of seeing this as a threat, what about if you see it as an opportunity?
That's my point.
Yeah.
My point is
it's an opportunity.
We are indifferent. We don't know that these things are happening, and our faith is not really serious enough to be even concerned about it.
Very good point. So that's the issue then.
Yes.
Where is the seriousness of your faith and what's its position?
You know, Roland Miller did the kind of thing that he did in the 1980s.
Right.
He referred to the Islam faith as really an unnecessary faith, because he said if Christians had lived out their faith, Northern Africa was all Christian, you know, and then, of course, the Muslim faith was established. And he was a real strong support. He had so many Muslim friends. But that's the issue for us is how we live out our faith in a spirit of Christian love. And of course I know my own weaknesses, and you know yours. We all fail, we're all sinners. And so we live in our own little world, and we're spotted. Our light comes on us, our life is good, and we don't really... If you read the magazines like The Voice of the Martyrs, and the persecution that is happening in so many Muslim countries who seek accommodation in our nation but will not yield a single thing for those who believe otherwise. There is no personal right or freedom of expression in any of these countries. And so if we can put our head in the sand and just think, well, that's the way the world is. And life is good here in Calgary. I love it. But that is the world we live in, the complexity of it all.
So just let me respond briefly to your last comment, and then let's take a break for coffee for 10 minutes or so. There are virtually no Christians in Saudi Arabia. Shias are under great pressure there. Ahmadiyyas are outlawed. There's all kinds of issues within those countries around pluralism, both within what I would call the House of Islam. Right at the moment, there is an extraordinary movement in Turkey, which has been underway for many years, initially led by Bediüzzaman Said Nursi, for a kind of extraordinary reform in Turkey. This was when Atatürk was in power. And as a result, Said Nursi, who had been a mufti in the Ottoman army, saw the end of the Ottoman Empire. He was seen as dangerous, so he was imprisoned, put in mental institutions, exiled, under house arrest for all of his life until he died in 1960 with the police at the door. But he led a kind of Samizdat movement for the reform of Islam. He wasn't a secularist. He obviously, Atatürk really was afraid of him. But he was amazing. He said that anybody who uses Islam for political purposes is a blasphemer. He was essentially a pacifist. He was deeply interested in science, a whole range of things. That movement probably had 10 million people as part of it, around the time that the last government in Turkey was elected. It is an amazing movement. It reminds me very much of Pietism in Norway and Sweden. It's a readers' movement. They're getting together to read and to talk together about their life in the world. So you don't hear anything about that. Right at the moment, of course, one of the manifestations of this movement is led by a man called Gulen, and that movement has been important, I think, to the election of the government that is there in Turkey, elected 10 years ago. But right now, we see that government turning on this movement as well. Now, that government has an openness to religion and a concern about the religious life and wants to restore a place for the religious life. But what do we read about it in the newspapers in North America? Well, we largely read it painted as if it's Islamist. Is it? Well, I think clearly anybody who looks at it seriously knows we don't know. But let me tell you something. If I was the Patriarch of Constantinople, I'd be somewhat relieved. Because the Patriarch of Constantinople has had no ability from 1925 on to educate one Christian in that world. You know how many Christians are left in Turkey? 7,000 in a country of 70 million. 21,000 Jews. Atatürk said, you can't speak about your faith. The government elected 10 years ago or 12 years ago has been negotiating to open, to have the patriarch as well as Muslims open schools. And the Muslims have begun that process. But for the first time, a Christian can too. So here's the rub with that issue. If we look at countries where there is no tolerance of pluralism, where what you describe, I agree, it is tragic. But you know what happens when Muslims come to Canada? And when we create space? They go home too. There is this movement back and forth. The gifts of a society are a rhizome. They'll pop up in other places. So I suggest to you another way of thinking about it is that instead of looking at a quid pro quo here, if you can't have a church in Saudi Arabia, then to hell with you, you can't have a mosque here. I say let's play the long game. Let's play the long game. Let's try and figure out how to get Saudis to stay here, instead of just to come to be made to get specialties in medicine. University of Alberta brings 70 of them every term. The woman who was here that I talked about earlier came here, and everything was paid for her, including 3 trips home every year. Nobody pays taxes. Nobody pays for Medicare. Nobody pays for any of that in Saudi Arabia. So if you ask, why don't Saudis stay? Why would they stay? We have to figure out how to make them stay for a while so they can go back and so they can help bringing some of the gifts of this part of the world into that world. But we also need some of the gifts from that part of the world in our world. And one of them you've also flagged, a seriousness about their faith. My archbishop friend, when we were in Syria, said, my oh my, I wish that my Orthodox faithful were 10% as serious as the average person on the streets of Damascus. So, I mean, you're flagging a couple of things here. But I suggest to you that immigration to this part of the world and creating space for things to be done here has and will have an effect on all of those countries. But it's not a short game. But if we think of it as a quid pro quo, we'll get nowhere. We'll be back in the Hundred Years' War. So I just suggest that. Let's have coffee.
I'm just thinking in terms of what you said. And of course, all of that is true. Complexity overwhelms all of us, I think, in this regard. But I think it's hard to really discern the voices that we hear today in all these areas. I think we all try to be faithful and loving, but to do the right thing is always difficult. And when I think of someone like Ali, I know that's only one voice. But if we are ignorant of that voice, we have our head in the sand. I don't like extremes in religion and politics, but the pendulum just doesn't sit very well in the middle. That's just the fact of history. It goes back and forth, one extreme to the other. The difficulty of knowing how to respond. People who know me here at Messiah know I welcome refugees, and I'm a refugee, and we want everything possible to make me feel most welcome. But my concern is we are a very small group that and none of us are as informed and read as you are. The majority of people couldn't care less, were totally indifferent. And I'm afraid that by giving special accommodation of any kind to any group, we're fighting it with these special accommodations that are given to the rich, for example. There's a reaction eventually. That's how revolutions take place.
Right.
And I think when we begin to accommodate one group as opposed to others, that is so contrary to the democratic principles that we have striven for years.
Good.
So.
Well, I really appreciate that, and we will come back in 10 minutes or so, and we'll pick up on that. What then is the Christian responsibility? What then is the Christian's capacity to respond to this matter? Thanks. So I would like us to see if we can focus on what I call the Christian responsibility, the ability of Christians to respond, our response ability around the things that are concerns that you have. And we had articulated for us here at the end before we broke this sense that our society in general has moved in a direction towards accommodating particular people. And I think I hear in that, if I can ask you, all of you, I hear in it a sense of loss. Do I hear correctly? A kind of loss or fear of loss, maybe. For me, it is a sense of loss. Of the way in which I thought the world was. Well, let me just, I'll just give you my take on it. As many of you know, I was raised in this Norwegian pietist world. So I was raised really to understand two things. One is, I was raised to love the church and to love the world. But I was also raised to be suspicious of the church and suspicious of the world. And frankly, I wasn't sure which I should be more suspicious of. As a result of that, and because my parents were immigrants, I think I grew up with a kind of, you know, we left Camrose when I was 7. So everybody in my family had a sense of loss. We moved to Edmonton on my birthday, 15th of August. We all wept. We buried both my parents back here. It tells you something. So there was a sense that the community was broken, that somehow or other the economic issues of life had forced us into a different circumstance. I spoke recently at an event in Edmonton, and a man came up to me and introduced himself, and I didn't dare say what I wanted to say to him, because it was his family that was largely the reason we left. My father built an addition to a commercial building here on Main Street, based on a good Norwegian handshake, and was never paid for it. So we were impoverished by it. Didn't have a choice. But that's a minor issue. So I grew up with a sense that Christian culture was shattered. And I suppose I grew up with that sense. I mean, I think if I'd been Anglican, I wouldn't have had that sense, because the Queen hadn't disappeared. And, you know, Anglicans put the world together differently. But certainly in my religious formation, there was this sense that Christian culture was shattered. Not the faith, still had the relationship to God and all of that, but that the culture itself was shattered. That's a pretty good pietist perspective. It's one of the insights of that world. And I worked on it a lot to understand it. But I suppose 20 years ago or so, and I mean, I came to the view that Christian culture was shattered because, in fact, we'd made these decisions. We had decided to move into a different kind of world. This wasn't a Christian country, you know. I mean, it has those roots historically, but decisions were made. And those decisions were made up for very good reasons. I mentioned one of them. I mean, just the whole shaping of education. It's a huge thing to decide that you're no longer going to teach history, you're going to teach social studies. It's not that there isn't good things in social studies, there clearly is. But that decision masked something. What it masked was the expunging from the curriculum of any content that the new generation of good secular thinkers saw as past and passé, as having to do with the primitive past, mainly a Christian past. You know, that was the great secularist theory developed in the 60s. We're all going to become good secular people. It's just going to take some time. Because that's the sensible thing to do. That's the end result of democracy. And it's the end result of human rights. And it's the end result of being a modern person. Obviously, religion is a primitive part of the human culture, and it's a kind of primitive part of the mind, the brain. Well, I happen to love religion and the faith of my father and mother, and so for me it was a sense of loss. And so I studied it. You know, that was my response. Study it. Understand what's happened in the culture. So for me, the big issue was, what has really happened to the human spirit in the 20th century? And my way of doing this was to go into religious communities and to spend time talking with devout men and women. Not with people that saw themselves as secularists. Don't get me wrong, I think the secular is one of the greatest religious gifts to the modern world. But that's another story. But the secularist mentality is different than that. I wasn't very interested in the people within those communities who saw themselves as secular because they were just too glib. I wanted to talk to the devout people, the people for whom there was grappling and struggle and the desire to be faithful, and they were working at things. Just as I would much prefer to listen to Yehudi Menuhin than I would listen to me scratch on the violin without even knowing how to read music. Religious people are first and foremost like athletes and like artists, people with a discipline. They are first and foremost disciples. Whether they are Muslim, Buddhist, Jews, fundamentalist Christians, Catholics, Lutherans, no matter what they are. The devout people are people that have taken a discipline. They have placed themselves in a discipline. And like any discipline, the religious discipline gives you a certain capacity. And it nurtures those capacities. Religious disciplines, when they're lived out thoroughly, I think, free you from fear and free you from desire. It doesn't happen instantly. It takes time. But it means your posture isn't the same as the people who are filled with fear and desire. There's lots of reasons to be afraid of lots of things, lots of reasons to desire certain things. I'm not a Puritan on this. But there is a kind of spiritual journey that leads you to a somewhat different posture. In any case, despite that struggle around our culture, and I ended up spending lots of time in various immigrant and refugee communities, I really preferred them to everybody else, mainly because I found that the people there could talk a lot better than my colleagues at the university. Give me conservative Mennonites any day compared to my philosopher, religious studies, sociological friends. It isn't in the same universe. You know why? Because my Mennonite friends stand somewhere and care. Whereas my academic friends, it's not that one-on-one they can't be brilliant and really interesting and have lots to say one-on-one. But put them together in a room, and it's all posture. It's all political correctness. It's all not being called out. That's why they've got tenure, so they can be so conservative. It's a fright and boring. But it highlights a problem. So what I saw here a number of years ago was, you know, initially I'd seen the axe of modernity put to the tree of culture. Not only culture, but my culture. But about 20, 30 years ago, I realized that that axe was now being put to the tree of the civil life. The tree of the civitas. Initially, it was argued in terms of postmodernism. It was argued that, really, when you look at it, nobody's ideas are any better than anybody else's. And if truth be known, you can never really understand anybody else's ideas anyways. We'll talk about a conversation stopper. You know, even if that's true, I'm not going to believe it because of what it does to thinking together. We need to think together. And even more so when we do not understand the other. Even more so when we do not understand the other. So, part of what I hear in this beautifully articulated concern is this sense of loss, not only about Christian culture, but also loss about the civil life, or fear that it's going to be lost, because there is a new set of ultimate values that are coming into play, and they don't quite fit with what I thought the world was. So part of it is focused on, you used the word commonly used is accommodation. And part of the fear was, how do we accommodate? Or why are we being forced to accommodate a variety of people? So let's step back. What do you understand to be the Christian responsibility to the civil life? What is the Christian responsibility to the civil life? Now, you can understand the Christian responsibility to your neighbor, the Christian responsibility to your enemy, the Christian responsibility to the other. You know, we all love the story of the Good Samaritan. But what's the Christian responsibility to the civil life? And in a world like ours, in a society which is democratic, a society which is pluralistic, what is our responsibility? When I began, the first time I went into El Rashid Mosque in Edmonton, which is probably 1972, something like that, there were 33,000 Muslims in Canada. I watched at that mosque the whole of the House of Islam come. It was colorful. Much better headdresses. Different kinds of hats. I have a marvelous, had photographs at the museum of this work in which I saw the Muslim men at the Friday prayer lined up in 1972 or 73. Not one of them had anything on their head, only the imam leading them in the prayer. 20 years later, you see, you can identify where they're all from because of what they've got on their head. It's charming. In the last census in 11, there were 1,053,000 Muslims in Canada. That's a pretty big leap. You know, it's like, and even from 2001, in that decade, it's a leap of 81%. So I suppose if one looks at that statistic, one could get a little nervous. if one feared what the implications were going to be, and that the implications were contrary to what one values about Canadian society. Those people come from all over the world. They come from all the wings of Islam. And I would say that they also represent all of the sensibilities and concerns and preoccupations within the Muslim world. If I was in a mosque, in the basement of a mosque, talking to Muslims about exactly the same issue, I would actually, I expect, hear virtually all the same concerns. Except maybe one, since I suppose maybe those people have been banished to some other church. You know, you might hear a few virulent voices as well. They exist. So, what's the Christian responsibility to the civil life in the midst of pluralism, where you have new people arriving with a different faith? Now, if we think of our responsibility as citizens in a democracy, it's a different question than Christians. If you're a citizen of a democracy, you want these people to vote. That is, you want them to participate in the civil life. If you don't want them to participate in the civil life, you're really seeding problems. You want to find a way for them to participate, and participate quickly, because you want them to have a vested interest in the society. But of course, democracies are funny places. And I think one of the great contributions of the 20th century, which I would argue has its roots in Christianity, is an attempt to pour the oil of gladness on the danger of democracy. Have you thought about what's going on in Ukraine? Or what went on in Egypt? I mean, the list is endless. Democracies are amazing, amazing way of putting the world together. But the danger is that democracy can become also a form of the very problem it replaces. We move from the divine right of kings to the divine right of the majority. And that looks like an improvement, unless you're not part of the majority. Then you might prefer the king. So the Syrian archbishop that I spent time with in Syria, in Damascus, it's the only place I could get a glass of wine was I had to go to the Christian quarter. Who was kidnapped a while back, and we haven't heard from again, were the Shia scholar and imam who I spent time with, who was giving the khutbah in the Shia mosque, Damascus, when a man walked in with a vest, pulled the string. Assad must look pretty good. Stable. At least you've got some space. But in a democracy, we texture the divine right of the majority with human rights. It's the way of trying to give a voice to these minority groups. But you know what? Once you've gone down the pike, as we have here, all of a sudden that also has to become the court of last resort for what was previously the majority. I have news. I suppose most of you know this. Canada isn't a Christian country, and Christians aren't the majority. not only aren't they the majority, they are becoming far less significant. But I have good news. We're Democrats, and we have human rights. So just as the Hutterite that doesn't want their picture taken, or the woman in Chador who wants to vote, has the opportunity of making their case before the Human Rights Tribunal and then before the courts, so does Trinity Western when it comes to wanting to have a law faculty. But that's the way they gotta go, for better or for worse. So we are now in a position of deep negotiation around these individual rights, but also collective ones. What is a community's right? Now, when it comes to that issue, we also have moved down the pike a little bit in Canada. I fear speaking about this with Alan in the room, because I'm no lawyer, God knows. Thanks be to God for that. I was blessed, Alan. Human rights has a history. And my own sense is that our understanding of human rights not only has a history, but it participates in a history. It's born, at least in part, out of that amazing insight at the heart of the Jewish and Christian faith, and also at the heart of Islam. You know what it says in Islam, in the Quran, about the human being? In the Quran it says, you are the mirror of God. You are the caliph. It's a charming word, huh? You are the caliph of creation. And of course we know from Genesis 3 that we are in the image of God, and Jesus Christ as teacher and model and savior, healer, rescuer, teaches us with a clarity unmeasured that each of us and every other person that comes into the world shares in the fullness of dignity. So human rights has its taproot there. But there's a problem. Human beings, well, according to our law, are individuals, but according to any good sense, are not just individuals. We have communities of people with community aspirations. How do those work in light of this situation? And furthermore, we have human rights which compete against each other. What do we do about that? The freedom of speech is a treasure. It is a treasure. And the freedom of religion is a treasure. And what happens when they collide? Which one supersedes? So this is part of our struggle. Did you want to speak to this?
I was just saying, you said when they collide, then you use wisdom, the God-given wisdom. That is the answer in that. And it sorts it out.
Yeah, over time, perhaps. The Holy Spirit moves slowly. Wisdom in the court system, wisdom in human rights tribunals, yeah, perhaps. But it's a struggle. It's a negotiation. It's difficult. So my sense is that for Christians that care deeply about their faith and also care about the gifts of Christianity within the context of Canadian culture, we can sometimes feel that this loss, because we're no longer in command, no longer in control, no longer can we pull that trump card, if we ever did. But it certainly can't be done now. And so there's this loss. Not only that, but I think I'm fair in saying this, there is a kind of attitude within our society, pretty ubiquitous, that you can still kick around. You can't kick anybody around, but you can still kick Christians around. We're certainly Catholics. I mean, maybe I'm wrong about that. I don't know if I'm overly sensitive about it. I've done plenty of that kicking myself. But if I'm right about that, if that really does dominate in the media, then that sort of adds another layer to this problem in terms of our own way of seeing things. If we suffer from a sense of loss around the hegemony of Christian culture and the place of Christian culture within our society. And then there's been a whole string of major legal battles that have shaped public culture. No, not the least of which is the issue around gay and lesbian brothers and sisters and their place within our institutions. And the church, your church, as well as others, has suffered in the midst of that struggle. There's the whole issue of the missionaries and residential schools and the attempt to bring to the First Peoples communities Western education as opposed to put them in a human zoo. And we got lots of blowback, lots of struggle around that. Don't know quite what to do with it. So those issues are there, and frankly, I mean, my sense is that many churches and many Christians have been very back on their heels. No longer very confident about how to engage things. And that all sits in the context of what I think is the big story here over the last 100 years, which is the enormous battle within Christian churches almost everywhere between evangelical literalists and liberal modernists, a battle around what the Bible itself means and what being a Christian means. And that's had an effect on major Christian forms of the revelation. So while that's all the case, or it seems to me to be the case, and while as Christians one needs to be alert to where those things sit within one and how they shape one's way of seeing and knowing, ought they be the place one stands as a Christian to respond? Do they really have any place in shaping our ability to respond? Or is our ability to respond rooted someplace else? That sometimes we forget. If we think of Jesus Christ, our model and teacher, and the one who anoints us, the one who enlivens us, the one who invites us to the fullness of life, on what ground did he stand to respond? To respond to virtually anything that he came across in his life. To respond to, I'll come to you in a minute. I want to walk around the question a little bit. Give people a chance to think about it. What did he make of those who were within his own community who had not understood in any serious way the depth of the gift of the revelation around being the spouses of the Creator of the world? What did he make of those people within his own community, likely within his own family? Who were really saying, enough already. Let's get on with being a little more modern. The temple's ridiculous. What did he say to those within his community who decided that, you know, it was about bloody time that the Romans took over? And yeah, they're going to ask us to worship other gods, but you know, you can pretend. Nobody believes that stuff anyways. What did he make of the sick, the suffering, the outcast? In all those circumstances, what's the stance? What's the orientation? That's a nice word to use, huh? What's your orientation? In the midst of what we fear. So what do you make? What do you make of that?
She would like to speak to it.
It seems that you're painting us as pretty weak. And whatever is happening in the world is real, and it is awful. But as Christians, if we believe what we read in our Bible, and if we want to live it out, what we do in our baptism, and that is the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. And if I believe Jesus is in me and I in Jesus, then I died with him in the cross, on the cross. I was buried, I was in the tomb, and I rose with Jesus. And the power that Jesus gives us in his name is available to me and to all Christians that truly believe. And in the power of that, by the power of God Almighty, we really do not have to fear. God is in charge yet. Even if the Muslims want to take over the world. Hitler said, and he said, and he sang it, I lived in Germany, and I had to sing it too, because I came to Canada when I was 19, and we sang, today Germany belongs to us, and tomorrow the whole world. How far did he go with it?
Yeah. Can you say a little bit about that power that you see emerging from the resurrection? What is that power about?
What is the resurrection power that I believe personally? Okay, the power that I have being resurrected with Jesus is to overcome, to endure, and to go forward with the protection of the blood of Jesus. I've come this far, and I'll keep on going.
Okay. Overcome, endure, and go forward. For others, want to speak a little bit?
I think your expression of the loss that we face is only a part of the story. I would lament if that was the whole story. It'd be sad. From a Christian perspective, the way I see it is actually, you expressed it well enough, is that we need to stand up for that which is loving and kind and good and helpful to our neighbor. And it's not always easy to know what that is. But I would think that my focus would be on that part rather than looking at the loss. History changes. These losses have occurred in every movement in history. I wrote my master's thesis on the temperance prohibition question in Saskatchewan. Prohibition was defeated because there was an influx of immigrants. Simple as that. They had a different perspective. And that's the way it's always going to be. It's not the end of the world. And our faith is in God is and express it so well. Yeah. But on my focus would, I'm much too of an activist to sit back and think, well, you know, it's no use. It's a loss.
So what does it mean for you then? What does the activism mean? In terms of your the concern you express.
Well,
you express a concern that Islam was going to have a transformative effect on Canada.
Yes.
So what's the activism about it? Well,
the activism, from a Christian perspective, I need to live out my Christian faith, and I don't want to itemize how I do that. Each one of us needs to address that, I think, in our own way, as to how we love our neighbor. That's the eternal question. There's no simple answer. I can't have any recommendation for others as to how you do that. But I know as a faith community, the Christian church is a declining community. Our influence isn't what it used to be. It's a passé. Who cares what the church says nowadays? But I am concerned that there will be reaction to this, and it will be a very conservative reaction in the Christian faith that will be equally concerning for me, from my perspective. And I see it happening now in many areas of our life. The reaction is beginning. I think it's very clear what's happening politically in Europe in some areas, but certainly happening in the area of faith in North America.
So what's your responsibility as a Christian towards that reaction? I mean, you have a responsibility, if I've understood you correctly, you have a responsibility towards your concern about how Islam, Muslims, may get accommodated in a variety of ways. So that's one piece of the puzzle. But the other piece is the reaction that you flagged. You spoke about it a little bit to me over the coffee break, which I think is a very important point. When you see that there is going to be a reaction within people who claim to be Christian that will be hostile and angry. I mean, we've seen this already in a number of places. What do you say to Terry Jones, the pastor in Florida that decided to burn the Quran? Like, what is the responsibility of Christians in the face of Terry Jones? And what did you do? Anything? Pardon?
Let common sense prevail. I think
comes into being, into play that way. But as a Christian, if you go forward in Christian love without being stupid, you know, there is a way of a common sense, Christian love and so on, that you don't do anyone any harm. And but deliberately, and for that you work for the common good. That is really what Christianity is all about, not to oppress, to love your neighbor. What does it mean? It means I help you when you're down. At the same time, I don't want you to take advantage of me.
So the common good, if I've understood you correctly, in response to my larger question, part of the Christian responsibility to the civil life is to care for the common good. But I also think I heard, maybe I did not, maybe I heard misheard, that there is a concern that the common good isn't necessarily shared by people who've come here more recently, that they want to be accommodated in a way that you see against the common good. Have I understood that?
Yes.
Is that true? Is that a fear?
That's what I said, within the law.
Within the law?
Within the context of my rights.
And within the context of your rights? All of those are civil.
Yes.
I'm asking about your faith.
Well,
what does your faith say to you about that? Not about what civil rights says or about what the law says. I mean, I appreciate those things, but what does the faith say to you about that?
My faith says that there is someone higher than I that knows better than I, and he will also lead and guide me in wisdom on how I have to handle the circumstance that I come upon at the moment. Not to be afraid, but go forward and face what comes at that time. If I can prevent a lot, I will do it.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't always prevent everything.
Okay, that's really nicely spoken. I appreciate that. So let me up the ante. Now, just a second. I'm just thinking. We need to think. I really think you put your finger on something so important that I want to just pull it forward if I can. If as a Christian, again, we exist in these various spheres and they're related to each other, human rights, law, the common good, and then our faith. You know, this is a footnote. I like footnotes. I was taught that the one thing about my faith is that it was never captured by rights, was never captured by law, was never captured by the common good. It was always capable, and I think you pointed to this, was always capable of moving, in some sense, of transcending those very good things. But it transcends them. It's not bound by them. And that's really what I'm trying to get at. If you fear that the common good is going to be compromised by Muslims because we accommodate them to their religious devotional perspectives, their sense of piety, then what's your response as a Christian? Remember, accommodating them to their piety, to their sense of religious discipline, what's the response of Christians? What's the faith response to that? Any sense? Did you want to speak to this now? I mean, was this part of what you wanted to speak to? Or did you want to shift it?
Oh, yeah, I'm just doing a shift in my head here.
Well, let me ask first, if you don't mind, before you shift. Do you see that question? Do you see that issue? Or am I talking about something that's too abstract? I mean, is that a real matter? Well, then hold it in your mind and let's listen to our colleague here.
When you ask the question, what is our Christian response to civil society? I thought about the fact that as Christians or people of faith, of any kind of faith that they take seriously, it's always going to impact on what they believe and how they act and how they respond.
Ah.
Excuse me?
Not you. I'm listening.
Oh, I thought you said not.
Well, I think your faith is just a matter of your heart. It's just in your little pea-picking heart. And it's about you and God. It's nothing to do with the world.
Oh, I disagree with you.
So do I.
I spent a number of years in India and in Nepal. And it was in those years that I found that my faith was really challenged. Mm-hmm. And that also I grew enormously from interacting with my friends who were Muslim, who were Hindu, and who were Buddhist. And in our office, I found it to be very interesting because when we would have meetings, people would say, from my Buddhist perspective, I really think we ought to move this way. And somebody else would say, well, as a Hindu, I think if we do this or this, we could actually make it work. And then in the end, they would always say to me, and Ruth, now, how do you think it should go as a Christian? And so we would have these marvelous dialogues, and between us we could come to some way of dealing with the issue. But for me, the richness was in the dialogue, and the richness was in the understanding that our faith does impact on how we relate to different problems and issues. And that for me was an enormous, wonderful thing to learn. And I learned that from my other brothers and sisters. I did not learn that in the church.
So thank you for that. There's a couple things in it that are worth thinking about. You said that your faith has everything to do with your place in the civil world. In other words, your faith is comprehensive. Or as we would say in Christian thought, my faith is Catholic. You know, when we say that in the creed, we don't mean the Pope. We mean universal. It touches all aspects of life. And if we were sitting in a mosque with Muslims, they would all turn, as you said that, they would all become Pentecostals. And they would say, preach it, sister, preach it. Amen, amen. Because Islam has a very sharp notion of the fact that the revelation and the gift of the faith sheds light everywhere in your life. Part of the challenge of Islam, just as it has been a challenge for Christian culture and Christians and Christian churches over the last 400 years, is what happens to that reach? What is my stance in connection to that reach that the faith has, that the revelation has? When I find myself with Buddhists and Hindus and Muslims and secularists and atheists and what have you, how then do I position myself? Do I just back away and assume there's this neutral secular space where my voice doesn't count? Or do I marshal the forces and push the others out and say our voice is the normative voice? Or do I accept the fact that I am around the table with others and speak out of the fullness of my heart and the best of my mind to these matters and have some confidence, to use the lovely teaching of our faith, as our sister here spoke about it, some confidence that the spirit that makes all things whole can be counted on. Not to win, but to draw life from death. Not to win, not to be triumphant, but to see that there's resurrection in all moments where we fear death and fear the end. We don't have nearly enough time, but I want to finish with a reading for you. There is a film that has been made of an incident that occurred in Dabrini, Algeria. The film is called Of Men and Gods. It's a Cistercian monastery in French and not so French Algiers. On the night of March 26th, 27th, in 1996, 18 years ago, 20 gunmen invaded the monastery of Notre Dame of Alatas in Dabrina and kidnapped 7 Trappist monks of French nationality. And a month or so later, the leader, Zitouni, of an armed Islamic group, claimed responsibility for the kidnappings and said that you must release some prisoners of their movement, which were held in Algerian and French prisons. Following a month of waiting for that release, they made another announcement saying that we've slit the throats of the monks. The killings were reported to have taken place on the 21st of May, and their bodies, but not their heads, were found 9 days later. It's an awful situation. But the film is amazing, and the incident is amazing when we think about Christian ability to respond. That Cistercian monastery came there, led by the abbot Christian de Chargey. It came there in the face of French colonialism. Christian de Chargey had been in the French military and had served in Algiers, and he decided he must go back wearing a different uniform, dressed in white, not fatigues, carrying the oil of gladness, not an M15. And he went there with his friends. And the whole film is about discernment. What do you do when you are in a circumstance which is so fraught? What is it that the Holy Spirit calls us to do? They developed a profound friendship with the neighboring villages. And when the Mujahideen came into the area, because this is part of the problem, what happens when virulent people capture the discourse and scare the hell out of everybody else and silence them? What do you do? Well, what these monks did, and what I seek to do, is you make friends. That's what you do. You make friends so that people don't assume that they are alone. That is, the people where a virulent group has captured a sense of who they are and has presented that to the world, whether it's Salman Rushdie, Ali, or Osama bin Laden, because they've all done exactly the same thing, just as Terry Jones wants to do it to my faith. You make friends across those boundaries and commit yourself to what the possibilities are there. So they made friends. There was a doctor that was one of the Cistercians. He ministered to the villages, to the people. They gathered with them regularly, went to their homes, they came to the monastery, and they pleaded with them not to leave. We need you here in the midst of this struggle, because this struggle was far less a struggle about the few Christians in that world than it was about who is going to define Islam. And that is our struggle. I do not want Ali to be right. I do not want Osama bin Laden to be right, or Salman Rushdie, any more than I want to give my faith over in the public square to any virulent television evangelist who is engaged in what I can only see as the work of the devil, shining a light, a narrow light on the faith, which has little or nothing to do with the rabbi from Nazareth. Before they were taken, kidnapped that night in this horror, the abbot, Christian de Charzay, wrote a letter. And I want to finish with this letter and with the question, what is the responsibility, what is the ability to respond of Christians out of this extraordinary moment? This letter was opened on Pentecost Sunday by the leader of the Cistercians who received it. Pentecost Sunday on May 26, 1996. It begins, facing a goodbye. You must remember, the military had visited the monastery, the politicians had visited the monastery, the French diplomats had visited the monastery, the head of the Cistercians from the Vatican had visited the monastery, all saying you must leave. But they didn't. So here's his letter, facing a goodbye. If it should happen one day, and it could be today, that I become a victim of the terrorism which now seems ready to engulf all the foreigners living in Algeria, I would like my community, my church, and my family to remember that my life was given to God and to this country. I ask them to accept the fact that the one master of all life was not a stranger to the brutal departure. I would ask them to pray for me, for how could I be found worthy? How could I become worthy of such an offering? There's a stance for you. I ask them to associate this death with so many other equally violent ones which are forgotten through indifference or anonymity. My Shia brother in Syria, my Archbishop brother, my life has no more value than any other, nor any less. In any case, it has not the innocence of childhood. I have lived long enough to know that I am an accomplice in the evil which seems to prevail so terribly in the world, even in the evil which might blindly strike me down. I should like, when the time comes, to have a moment of spiritual clarity which would allow me to beg forgiveness of God and of my fellow human beings, and at the same time forgive with all my heart the one who would strike me down. I could not desire such a death. It seems to me important to state this. I do not see, in fact, how I could rejoice if the people I love were indiscriminately, if the people I loved were indiscriminately accused of murder. It would be too high a price to pay for what will perhaps be called the grace of martyrdom. It would be too high price to pay for what will happen, for what will perhaps be called the grace of martyrdom. To owe it to an Algerian, whoever he might be, especially if he says he is acting in fidelity to what he believes to be Islam. I am aware of the scorn which could be heaped on the Algerians indiscriminately, on the Muslims indiscriminately. I am also aware of the caricature of Islam, which a certain Islamism fosters. It is too easy to soothe one's conscience by identifying this religious way with the fundamentalist ideology of its extremists. For me, Algeria and Islam are something different. It is a body and a soul. I have proclaimed this often enough, I think, in the light of what I have received from it. I so often find there the true strand of the gospel, which I learned at my mother's knee, my very first church, precisely in Algeria, and already inspired with respect for Muslim believers. Obviously, my death will appear to confirm those who hastily judged me naive or idealistic. Let him tell us now what he thinks of his ideals. But these persons should know that finally, my most vivid curiosity will be set free. This is what I shall be able to do, God willing. Immerse my gaze in that of the fathers to contemplate with him his children of Islam. Just as he sees them, all shining with the glory of Christ, the fruit of his passion, filled with the gift of the Spirit, whose secret joy will always be to establish communion and restore the likeness, playing with the difference. For this life lost, totally mine and totally theirs, I thank God, who seems to have willed it entirely, for the sake of that joy in which everything, and in spite of everything, in this thank you, which is set for everything in my life from now on, I certainly include you, friends of yesterday and today, and you, my friends of this place, along with my mother and father, my sisters and brothers and their families, who are the hundredfold granted as was promised. And also you, my last minute friend, who will not have known what you were doing. Yes, I want this thank you and this goodbye to be a God bless for you too. Because in God's face, I see yours. May we meet again as happy thieves in paradise, if it please God, the Father of us both. Amen. Inshallah. Thank you.